From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Your Honor, when I told you that I was a high school teacher in California, you said to the court, quote, "If he's a high school teacher, he shouldn't be acting so stupid by protesting." Your Honor, if it were not for protesters, I have to remind you, you would not be anywhere near the position at the bench from which you currently preside. For one thing, the land under your feet would still be a colony of the Kingdom of England. Furthermore,
From the battle in Seattle. Today, we'll hear from students from high school and teachers who were on the streets, and women from around the world sum up what happened at the World Trade Organization. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper's decision to leave office has not dampened demands for an investigation into the performance of the city, as well as Seattle Mayor Paul Schell, in planning for and handling World Trade Organization protests last week. Meanwhile, hundreds of people are expected to pack the downtown library tomorrow to tell the Seattle City Council just what went wrong during the World Trade Organization protests. And former South African President Nelson Mandela and his wife, Graca Machel, will arrive in Seattle this morning to kick off a tightly controlled 3-day visit. The trip, arranged as a fundraiser for Mandela and Michelle's charitable foundations, will be filled with gatherings of school children and business people, community leaders, and college students. The general public will not have much opportunity to see Mandela, however. What limited events are public are sold out. This news from Sierra Leone. Despite a ceasefire and the arrival of UN peacekeepers in Sierra Leone, the security situation has deteriorated markedly in recent weeks, with renewed rebel fighting and serious violations of human rights and humanitarian law. This according to a UN report. Attacks on civilians have frequently involved rape, abduction, and harassment, and more than 2,000 children registered as missing since a rebel incursion in January in western areas of the country remain unaccounted for, this according to Kofi Annan. And this news from Chechnya. A leading Russian general in Chechnya has denied that Moscow's leave-or-die warning to residents of the capital Grozny is aimed at civilians. The commander of Russian troops in the Caucasus said the threat was aimed at bandits and not the tens of thousands of civilians hiding in the city. But the United Nations Refugee Agency has warned that there is a very real risk that thousands of Chechen civilians could die if Russia continues its assault on the breakaway republic. And this news from Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams has made a formal complaint to the British and Irish governments following the alleged discovery of a bugging device in his car. Adams said it was a, quote, highly sophisticated listening and tracking device found in a car which he and the Education Minister, Martin McGuinness, used during the Mitchell review and to travel in meetings with the IRA. This news from Detroit. The top suspect in a string of schoolgirl rapes was arrested last week for stalking a child, only to be released and watched by authorities until DNA evidence linked him to some of the crimes. The 27-year-old man was freed on Thursday. He was arrested again late yesterday after DNA tests connected him to 3 of the crimes. And from San Francisco, attorneys for biotechnology giant Hoffman LaRoche promised to appeal a judge's ruling that one of its patents used in DNA analysis was questionably obtained and is invalid. U.S. District Judge Vaughn Walker yesterday upheld a challenge by Promega Corporation, which argued that scientists got the important patent in 1990 by misrepresenting their experiments and falsely claiming advances over previous discoveries. Those scientists work for Cetus Corporation, which sold rights to the patent and a DNA replication process to Hoffman LaRoche of Switzerland for $300 million in 1991. This news from Ohio. The federal government hasn't kept its promise to pay for expanded health screenings of uranium workers in Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee. This according to the Columbus Dispatch. The latest federal budget has included $7 million for the programs, but Congress removed the funds. As a result, thousands of people exposed to highly radioactive materials aren't getting medical checkups that could save their lives. More than 300 current workers at the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon are awaiting screening. From Tokyo, the doomsday cult that released deadly nerve gas into Tokyo subways is still capable of terrorism, this according to Japanese police. Shinrikyo plans to regroup around a former spokesperson, Fumihiro Joyu, who will be freed from prison at the end of the year. And relatives of a prisoner who died in an Oklahoma cell criticized a Justice Department report that concludes officers lied about the case but affirms that the prisoner committed suicide. The report by the department's inspector general was issued yesterday. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy, and to our listeners around the country. And the fallout from the battle in Seattle continues. Clearly, the resignation of Police Chief Norm Stamper, which I predicted, if you remember, last Friday, saying that I didn't expect it to be this quickly, will probably be followed, I'm sure, by the exit from the scene of the mayor himself. I mean, he is scheduled for re-election in 2001. Can you imagine him trying to conduct a fundraiser from Seattle's corporate community after the fiasco that he presided over last week? But interestingly, I think actually the police commissioner was among one of the most progressive around the country. So there were people already gunning for him, and this provided the excuse they needed to get rid of him. But one of the things that Stamper revealed last week was, or over the weekend, was how much pressure he got from the Secret Service, which was furious and threatened for a while to cancel the president's trip to Seattle because of the insecure security situation. So clearly, while President Clinton, on the one hand, was publicly creating the impression that he was in favor of these demonstrations, in private, the Secret Service and those around him were urging the city of Seattle to crack down. So when they begin to investigate what the cause of the chaos in Seattle was, they should not stop at the boundaries of King County and the city of Seattle, but direct themselves toward the White House itself.
And Seattle has a lot to do with right now, with the former president of South Africa and his wife, Graca Machel, who is a human rights activist in her own right, coming to Seattle today. It'll be interesting to hear if Nelson Mandela has something to say about the World Trade Organization. He certainly had something to say to President Clinton when he came to South Africa about the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which eventually got passed, saying that this is a law for your corporations, not for the countries of Africa. But also the ACLU, and we also did have talked about this over the last few weeks, has is pressing its legal challenge to the city's declaration, Seattle's declaration of a no-protest zone that took place last week. And I know the mayor got angry when the press was calling it a no-protest zone, calling it a security zone, but it was very clear cut. And later in the program, we're going to be talking to a teacher from Seattle. He and his students were involved in the protests in the streets. And at the end of the week, he was carrying some devil costumes of his kids because they had been damaged, and he had taken them out of a church. And a policeman came up to him and said, "What are you doing with those, and where are you going?" And he said he didn't want to make it so easy as to say he's a teacher. He said, "It's none of your business. That people don't, the police don't have a right to just come up to you and then possibly arrest you if they don't like what your answer is." So there is a lot of fallout and a lot of evaluation of what happened in Seattle. And I think it's also very important to point out that it was not just the state troopers. It was not just the National Guard. It was not just the Seattle police. And it was not just police from all over Washington State that were in Seattle last week. There were also representatives of each arm of the U.S. military there. Navy SEALs were there. FEMA was there, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the Army, the Air Force. Everyone was in town for the World Trade Organization.
It was quite a display of state power in a naked form, as we're not accustomed to seeing it within the United States. And certainly many of the overwhelming number of protesters were largely white and mostly middle class, so I'm sure that they especially were not accustomed to seeing this kind of naked display that many of us in the African American Latino communities have come to accept as a continuing situation in America.
Well, our listeners to Democracy Now! Can be sure we'll continue our coverage of the issue of corporate globalization. We don't just do it now. We have continued it far beyond any other media is doing right now in terms of daily coverage yesterday, looking at the issues of police brutality. We will continue to look at corporate power as we always do. It is not a one-day event for us or even a 3 or a 5-day event. But to get a sense, a wrap-up, we spoke to people at the end of last week, women from around the world, about the lessons they had learned. Then we're going to hear from a teacher from Northern California who was told by a judge that he was stupid if he was a teacher and he was in the streets of Seattle last week, told by a judge when he was being arraigned. And then we'll go to a Seattle classroom. Well, the kids will come to us and to a Seattle radio station and talk to us about what they learned. And they'll present a list to us of questions they have for the corporate media about the World Trade Organization. They were studying it for months before they took to the streets last Tuesday. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez as we do some wrap-up of the last weeks on the protests against globalization that took a very physical form last week in Seattle. We are joined by the same guests we had on the program on Friday, women from around the world who are fighting against corporate globalization and working towards grassroots globalization from the bottom up. And today we want to talk about where you each in your countries go from here. We're joined by women from Guyana, El Salvador, South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Jamaica. Let's start with Mahau Peko from the African Trade Network in South Africa.
I think that this past week has been a very rich experience for us, and it gives us the momentum to at least go back and talk more richly with women about the issues in terms of how we actually pull the very simple issues out of the trade agreements and begin to create campaigns around some of those issues, around seeds, around healthcare, around the issues of agriculture. And I think also what has been interesting for us in the last week is the way that we've been able to talk to some of our African governments at the WTO and beginning to actually get some legitimacy and some respect for our views from them, and how at least we can begin to seal some of those issues and begin to talk to each other at the national level about these issues so that we don't have to go all the way to Seattle to actually begin the dialogue there. So to strengthen that dialogue, to continue to lobby them in different directions from
all
the WTO.
All men in your delegation from South Africa?
No, actually we have a lot of women on the delegation of South Africa, so that has been good. The agricultural minister is a woman, the DG of agriculture is the woman, and there are quite a few senior trade officials who are also women in our delegation.
Oh, well, I have to believe that many of the official delegates and from the various governments in the third world, seeing what has happened in the United States, are going to be a little bit more receptive to the civil society in their own countries, thinking of what could possibly happen if their own populations begin to get mobilized over this issue of the WTO. Marta Benavides, when you go back to El Salvador, what will you take from here, and what will be your next steps in terms of continuing the battle over the WTO?
The first is to know that if we are united, we have already won. This is a very important point, to start from a position of power, to know that we are not powerless, but we are power, and we can create the conditions, not to be the alternatives, because we keep talking about alternatives, but that we are the answer to everything, that it is us humans that create the wealth and the conditions for how we live. And when I return home, I'm going to be sharing all this information in a variety of ways, because I work with urban and rural communities, and I work with the National University as part of a process of initiatives from the citizenry to create conditions also within national universities to create opinion. But we have a process in El Salvador that we call sustainability, and that is not talking about sustainable development, but about the processes that allow us to live a quality of life in a healthy environment without exploiting each other and without getting trade to be an exploitative way. So what we are talking about now in El Salvador is how do we create the conditions for governance that there has to be a culture of peace, but we can only get there through an education for peace. So all these materials are going to be checked and disseminated amongst the population, and we are going to be discussing a lot about that. But also, I have access to many communities in the United States, many processes in the United States, and part of what we have to do is create the conditions also in the United States that the people here also see themselves as who they are, citizens of the world, and not First Nations and Third World Nations and Rich Nations. And the other thing is that what I observe here, and I don't know if people in this country are aware of, is that there has been two coup d'etats. One is the WTO, that is a coup d'etat. And coup d'etats exist by force and secretively and by oppression and by force. And what happened in the streets of Seattle show also what a coup d'etat is. And people think that only in Latin American countries, or in Africa or Caribbean, there is coup d'etats. This is a coup d'etat, and that's what happened in Chile in 1973.
Marta Benavides of El Salvador is with the International Institute for Cooperation Amongst Peoples, focusing on rebuilding ecological sustainability and the livelihood base in rural areas as part of the country's peace process. Jocelyn Dow, also with us, president of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, WEDO. And the last time I saw Jocelyn was over a year ago, or actually just under a year ago. It was the beginning of International Women's Month, Working Women's Month, the month of March, and we were sitting around Bella Abzug's kitchen table. Bella Abzug, who died just a few weeks after that, and it's a pleasure to see you back from Guyana and sitting around this table with us as we assess what happens next after this massive rebellion against the World Trade Organization.
Well, there are two tasks one has. One has a national task. And in Guyana, one of the problems we have is we have a lot of internal division at the moment over race, over political divisions. And one of the things I think that women have to take and are trying to take control of is to say, look, stop the internal division. The enemy, the demon is outside. We have to find a national healing. We have to build a national consensus to really contain this degradation of our countries. And you know, the irony of all of this for us is, of course, nobody leads the governance discussion and tells you more about good governance than the United States of America. But what has been displayed here is such an example of bad governance. The WTO is such an organization that has no respect for governance issues. They exclude the small. They exclude their own members. They do not consult. They do not allow you to participate. And yet you have this dichotomy in which our governments, our peoples are told, you have to ensure that good governance is on the table. So we have to make that a reality for American citizens as well as for ourselves.
Jocelyn Dow, who is the president of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, founding member and executive director of Red Thread, a women's collective in Guyana. We are playing the tape of a conversation we had at the end of last week as these women gathered in the library of the basement of the United Methodist Church in downtown Seattle. It was a place where every day activists, hundreds of them, gathered to speak about different themes: labor, corporations, women, health care. And we decided just before we all left Seattle and dispersed, Jocelyn Dow now back in Guyana, to talk about where we go from here. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back with them in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Coming up on the show, we go to Seattle to speak with students and a teacher who are in the streets and the lessons they learned, but now women from around the world who converged on Seattle last week, as we continue with Jocelyn Dow, president of the Women's Environment and Development Organization.
I want to ask you something, Jocelyn. In the week that you've been in Seattle, you actually have been talking to some of the police women.
Yeah, well, you know, we were all in the bathroom together in one of the hotels, and we saw these women. They were looking really wiped out. So we said, well, you know, sisters, I want to tell you, I've been to every WTO meeting in the world, and this is disgraceful. And you all have really put on the worst example of police behavior that I have seen anywhere in the world in these few short days. And believe me, I've seen some. And one woman said, you know, she said, look, I haven't been home for 5 days. I haven't seen my children for 5 days. We were never even briefed on what this WTO was. This meeting took place. There was no briefing to us. We've been called in from different departments of the police and put on the street. And, you know, one of the things I think we have to impress on the police and the military is they are workers too. That ultimately their nexus is not with Bill Gates. You know, it's not with the corporations, it's with the people. And you have to build up a really sensitized people. And what is going on here is going to go on for them as well. You know, they're going to export prisoners to Mexico, and they're going to lose jobs in Seattle, right? Because, you know, we're going to move prisons to where it's cheaper to keep prisoners. Because that's the natural movement of this whole trade mechanism. But I think women have a real obligation now. We've seen a real mobilization of the trade unions and the environmental movement. And I think the important thing for us as women worldwide, and hopefully in the United States in particular, where, you know, you're the godhead of this system, is that what we are going to see is that women will take this to the Beijing Review. We are here to decide on Beijing Plus Five. We're looking at the Fourth World Women's Conference to review the 5 years since then, and I think we have a particularly urgent agenda.
When is that going to take place?
In June at the United Nations.
In New York?
Yes, but there are regional meetings going on all over the world, and I think one is scheduled for Seattle here.
The Western region.
Tandewe Nkomo, one of the issues, of course, that is still pressing for Zimbabwe is the issue of arms sales and its relationship to some of the discussions here. Are you going to be dealing with this issue of arms sales in the future? And what do you expect to do when you go back to Zimbabwe?
Yes. The issue of arms is very important to us. And like my friends have already mentioned, the lack of democracy that we've seen here in the U.S. pushes us to talk about, you know, the issue of arms. And we met in Zimbabwe on the 22nd to the 23rd of November as SADC small-scale farmers, as a network. And we were pushing for new issues. And one of the new issues was around arms trade. And we are calling for all countries caught in stimulating war by selling arms or allowing arms trade from their territory or through their territory should be brought before the dispute settlement board. And in case of recidivism, be expelled from WTO. And what I'm going to do, I'm not going only to work in Zimbabwe in terms of sharing this information about what happened here, but I also belong to an international network called Grassroots Women Working Together in Sisterhood. So that would mean I will share my experiences broader than just Zimbabwe. But we are also going to do a lot of, you know, campaigning and working with our governments around the issues of food security and seeds, patterning seeds and, you know, drugs by pharmaceutical companies, because they come to do research in our own countries and then we don't have access to the information that we've provided. We are going to work on those issues and we are going to work with other grassroots movement worldwide, because all these issues are affecting both developed countries and underdeveloped countries.
And Sherlene Barshefsky, the U.S. Trade Representative who ran the negotiations at the World Trade Organization's news conference, she was asked about the whole issue of biopiracy, the whole issue of corporations moving into developing countries and taking information and then talking about intellectual patent rights, that they then have the rights and going back to your countries and making it illegal for you to sell those drugs in your own country with developing pharmaceutical industries in your own countries. And she said, well, we're working on a way where if a country has a health emergency or health crisis, that they can get some kind of exemption. I think that's what she said. But there's a lot of language here that doesn't involve actual written rules. It seems that it's, well, Juan, you've been talking about this.
Yes, we've covered it actually this week several times in different segments. But I noticed, Jocelyn, you wanted to add something in this vein.
You see, I think one of the things we have to realize that one of the ways in which information is gotten is not only through pharmaceuticals. I mean, we have, for instance, in the Guyanas, a mapping of everything. All our flora and all our fauna is being done by the Smithsonian. Now, this raises issues for us because those things are lodged at our local university. I mean, concretely speaking, we neither have the technology nor the capacity, and you have agreements. But what happens since the United States has not signed off on all parts of the Biodiversity Treaty? Is the Smithsonian bound by the United States laws? Is it bound by the full Biodiversity Convention, for instance? These are issues that have to be raised because quite often things are discovered, not necessarily clearly from corporate radars. And these raise larger issues of, about ethics, about trust, and about the future. Because obviously people who are working now may be well-intentioned, but what will happen later? You know, for countries that were once colonies, there is no confusion about this. You know, the British had everything in Kew Gardens. And many things, you know, the entire world was mapped under the colonial British with Kew Gardens. And therefore, these repositories of information, what is the access? So you have, it's a very complex issue about whether it's just corporations or the link between the corporations and research and universities in the north.
Jocelyn Dow, president of the Women's Environment and Development Organization of Guyana. Mariana Williams, also from the Caribbean, is an economist working on gender and trade issues with an organization called Dawn Caribbean. She also works at the Institute for Law and Economics in Jamaica. Where do you go from here when you return?
Well, I think the work is at three levels, as Jocelyn pointed out, international, the regional, and the national. I think in Jamaica, the WTO has been becoming for some time a household word, almost like the IMF. Because since last June, Jamaican farmers have actually been out in the street demonstrating, because one of the effects of liberalization is the reduction of tariffs and non-tariff barriers, in particular on meat and dairy products. And that has caused Jamaica to be inundated by cheap subsidized and also some inferior quality meats from the U.S. and Canada, which has severely impacted our farmers. And they've taken to the street in June, July. And so there's been lots of questions posed to the government about WTO. So increasingly there's been big discussions on the radio talk shows and newspapers about globalization and trade liberalization. I think what Seattle does is to provide a way for us to go back and say that the government has kind of been on the defensive a little bit, in the sense that they've been saying, well, the WTO, and the sense that people think that they can't do anything about the WTO. And I think this massive mobilization of people in the U.S. and worldwide against the WTO provides a stimulation for discussing and for opening up that process among people in the Caribbean and in Jamaica. I think we have regional network, CAFRA, the Caribbean Associate of Feminist Research, that's been putting trade on the agenda. And the idea is to go back now and do the advocacy and the grassroots organizing with community groups, regional linkage among Caribbean women who have been identifying this problem. But I think this has given us a really good stimulating point to go back to talk about globalization and trade liberalization, and to get people energized and to get people moving and start realizing that, yes, this is something that we can do. It's not inevitable. It is not something that we cannot impact, because there are people globally who are working on this.
So in essence, the protests here have given the weak-willed leaders around in the third world a little bit more backbone now in terms of how they're going to stand.
Yeah, and I think also for governments who have been making arguments, similar arguments that NGOs have been making inside the WTO, but we're not listened to. I think the Caribbean delegation has been very strong about asserting about the negative impact, because in the Caribbean, we know globalization. I mean, our region, the geopolitical space, the Caribbean, was created by globalization. It's not benign. It killed people. It wiped out indigenous people. It brought us from Africa as slaves, endangered servants. So we know this process. It's not new to us. So it's been an experiment. It's now being brought to the rest of the world. So we're very clear, and I think our governments have recognized it. But in that atmosphere of intransparency and where dissenters are isolated and you're arm twisted into consensus, there's been problem in them being able to organize and generate solidarity amongst themselves and other governments. And I think the protests here and the massive organizing has actually changed something inside that space for the government, I believe.
I spoke to the Jamaican ambassador to the United States. He went to a congressional briefing to ask about the Caribbean Basin Initiative. Mm-hmm. Basically, NAFTA expanded to the Caribbean. Are you concerned about that? He was very much for it.
Well, I think that we recognize that we're having these multiple level of trade liberalization, because one of the response from our region also has been to integrate more and to try to consolidate CARICOM, which is our regional process, and to try to link to Central America and Latin America. But I think there's a sense in which people recognize and feel that since NAFTA is impacting us, whether we like it or not, that it's important to be part of that discussion to see to what extent we can actually help to set rules that will be beneficial to us. Because NAFTA has actually impacted Jamaica and the Caribbean in terms of the export processing zones, some of which have closed and have moved to Mexico and other parts of the world. So these trade arrangements that exclude you but have impact on your people have felt it's important to try to have some structural linkage to it for whatever reasons. Yeah.
And I'd like to ask, because we are talking about the Caribbean, Cuba is a member of the World Trade Organization. Was that gave us some briefings? What is happening in terms of Cuba and its role here?
Well, I think Cuba has been part of the Caribbean family, I mean, for a long time, and still very instrumental in helping to think through the process and to respond to globalization and trade liberalization, and has been instrumental and in helping with the regional process and trying to link to the regional processes in the Caribbean. But I think Jocelyn has some things she might want to say. I
mean, Jocelyn Dow of Guyana.
Yeah, one of the things, you know, Guyana has perhaps the closest link with Cuba. If it weren't for Cuban doctors, a lot of Guyanese won't survive in many of the difficult years. But more importantly, you know, when you talk about parity and fair and the rules being applied across the board, nothing is a greater violation of WTO than the Helms-Burton Law. I mean, the U.S. has imposed third country regulations to do with its all historic political and economic warfare in Cuba, and now stops drugs getting, pharmaceuticals get into Cuba from Europe, so that even X-ray film is a problem in Cuba. Now, I mean, so that this is rules for the mighty and rules for the weak, you know, where the mighty can apply any rule and the weak shall, you know, inherit nothing. And this is what it is. And, you know, one of the things I'm proud of the Caribbean position, and sometimes I'm always disappointed by the will, but I want to tell you, they were very clear here. They were very clear here about the WTO. It's a real do-and-die situation. And I want to give you an example of what's happening. You know, there was a march some months ago in one of those very small islands that produces bananas by farmers, 600 farmers, on the right to grow marijuana. Now, this is entirely new. They said, look, if we're talking about comparative advantage, the comparative advantage we have in trade is drugs and to the growth of marijuana. Now, this is illegal in that country, yet farmers were able to go on the street and say, look, now what resulted is they came in and they destroyed those fields. So you move pesticides in, you move a whole culture, a negative culture is now entering our economies because more and more people are turning to the narco economy to survive.
Jocelyn Dow, Marta Benavides, Tandiwe Nkomo, Mariama Williams, and Mahal Feko, women from Guyana. Jocelyn Dow, Marta Benavides of the International Institute for Cooperation Amongst Peoples in Salvador, Tandiwe Nkomo of Zimbabwe with the Organization of Rural Associations for Progress, Mariama Williams of the organization Dawn Caribbean in Jamaica, and Mahal Feko of the American Trade Network in South Africa, speaking to us as we were all leaving Seattle about where we go from here. And speaking of South Africa, Nelson Mandela and his wife, Graça Machel, are arriving in Seattle this morning for several days of meeting the people of Seattle. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move into the last segment of the show, beginning with a teacher from Northern California named Blaise Bonpain, who was arrested, held for 5 days in jail. He was one of the protesters last week. And when he was in jail, he wrote this letter to his judge.
Dear Judge Bonner, under oath in your courtroom today, you insulted me, America, the civil rights movement, and the current international movement to replace the WTO, in which I am a proud organizer and participant. I appeared before you as a jailed activist in favor of alternatives to the undemocratic and unaccountable dominance of the World Trade Organization, the WTO. The WTO is now responsible for overturning democratic decisions made by people all over the world. Prevalent examples of those democratic decisions that have been subverted include decisions made by people of the United States and the European Union, among many, many others. This overturning of democratic decisions is done by threatening sanctions against these countries if they are to implement environmental and labor rights protection laws, which their people have determined as necessary. The WTO calls laws like these, quote, trade barriers, because they may increase the overhead expense of billionaire corporations like Nike and Exxon. Your Honor, when I told you that I was a high school teacher in California, you said to the court, quote, if he's a high school teacher, he shouldn't be acting so stupid by protesting. Your Honor, if it were not for protesters, I have to remind you, you would not be anywhere near the position at the bench from which you currently preside. For one thing, the land under your feet would still be a colony of the Kingdom of England. Furthermore, because you are an African American, you and I would not enjoy the long-awaited basic rights of equality that were won by the organizing prowess and the inspiring sacrificial endurance of our civil rights movement here. Your Honor, it seems tragically clear that you would benefit from attending my world history class that we mentioned in court. Doing so can help you avoid the contagious embarrassment stemming from your apparently thorough lack of knowledge regarding the critical role of social and political activists throughout recorded history. You, and needless to say, the city government of Seattle, owe all activists everywhere a deep and comprehensive apology. You might specify in your apology activists such as Thomas Paine, Sojourner Truth, Eugene Debs, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., Dolores Huerta, Dr. Noam Chomsky, and of course us, the new international coalition of activists to halt the globalization of corporate colonialism while building toward the globalization of increasingly participatory labor governance and environmental sustainability. Judge Bonner, I hope to hear from you soon in circumstances which lend themselves more easily toward friendship, whether in my class, which you are welcome to, I gave you the phone number in court, or through a response letter in the Seattle Times. Thank you for your time and consideration, Blaise Bompain, Jr.
Blaise Bompain, a high school teacher from Humboldt, California, who spent 5 days in the general population of the Seattle jail, where he witnessed, among other things, a 75-year-old protester whose wrists were dripping with blood because her handcuffs were too tight. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear from another teacher, this one from Seattle, as well as his students who were in the protests on Tuesday. They have some questions for the media. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we go to KUOW, which is a Seattle public radio station. It is early in the morning there, and students and a teacher have gathered from Seattle's Nova High School. And they've issued a challenge to the Seattle media, who covered the meetings last week of the World Trade Organization and the protests outside. These students are taking a class on economic globalization, and they were in the streets. We're joined now by their teacher, Joe Swaya, a social studies and government teacher at Nova High School in Seattle, Savan Rosenbaum, who is a 12th grade student in Joe Swaya's class, and Nicole Bade, who is an 11th grader, also taking the class. We welcome you all to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good to be here.
Well, I'd like to begin with Joe Swaya. During the protests in Seattle, I ran into several students from Nova High School. In fact, they told me that about half the high school had turned out for the protests and that they had all been studying the World Trade Organization for months and knew about the protests for quite some time. What's been going on at Nova High School that so many students are much more aware than a lot of our political leaders?
Well, thank you. Well, we are a small, democratically run high school in Seattle, so students have a lot of input and say over what's taught. And some students were very interested in studying about the WTO because it seemed like it was this huge thing that was going to come to Seattle, and I felt that since it was an organization, an issue that affects everybody so much around the world, that we should study it. So we have taken the last few months to look at it in detail, look at the issues of substance with respect to the WTO, and we also incorporated street theater into it. We had the students learn about how to make puppets and how to do a street theater fashion show illustrating some of the issues of the WTO. So, yeah, after studying it for a few months and inviting people from both sides to a teach-in, our students were part of the very peaceful protests on Monday. They exhibited their very large street theater with puppets and also did a fashion show about some of the we called it a sweat, no sweat fashion show. It had a little play about the sweatshop practices around the world, but also positive alternatives that people can buy, where they can buy things that are not as exploitative to workers. That happened on Monday. On Tuesday, and that was part of the class officially, I should say, our presentation. On Tuesday, when we knew it was going to be a lot more sticky, I was there as a private individual. I wasn't there officially as a NOVA teacher, but our students had learned a lot about it, and many of them were there. And I was there with them, trying to keep it as peaceful as possible. And I was proud of how our students had really studied a lot about it and knew a lot about the issues, more judging from the media coverage than perhaps some of the reporters, I think, they knew. And I was proud of how peaceful they were.
Savon Rosenbaum, what happened to you on Tuesday morning? Where did you go, and why were you in the streets?
Well, I went down with the students' rally. First, we went through Garfield and tried to get as many kids out there, out from that school as we could. And then we went down to the all-school student rally, marching through the streets for at least a couple miles to downtown and joined up with the AFL-CIO march.
There was an all-schools protest?
Yeah, there was an all-school student rally. College students and high school students and even middle school students joined together, marching through the streets, making music, chanting. And then we went downtown and heard from students all around the world speaking of why they were protesting the WTO.
And then what happened? Nicole Bade.
Well, at that point, I had prepared a street theater. I'm a member of DAN, the Direct Action Network, and so I'd been using some of their facilities. And we did our street theater, and it got a really, really great reception. This was up at Seattle Central Community College.
What did you do?
And then it was a street theater of the devil and us playing cards and betting poker chips that had, you know, various things on them, such as dolphins. So the game went something like, I see your dolphins and raise you sea turtles.
There were huge devil puppets, Amy. They were just gigantic, and they were featured in media reports from a lot of European stations who really liked them.
And then we left that monument of the cards and the poker chips and went down, because I was in an affinity group that was, we had one puppet, and we were giving aid to people who were in lockdown down at the blockades, and we'd heard that some of the blockades were having a lot of trouble. So then we went down and helped them and helped a couple people block a freeway underpass and just made sure that everyone was okay and was in good spirits.
And this would have been around what time in the afternoon on Tuesday?
This was actually in the morning.
Oh, in the morning, okay.
We were a flying affinity group until about 1 o'clock, I believe. And then we decided to go down to the march and see what was going on there.
And what happened when you were on the front lines? And you were near the Sheraton Center, is that right? That's where a lot of the delegates were, and it was right next door to the convention center that the delegates were trying to get into.
Yes. What happened? Well, basically people would link arms, or they had high-tech blockades, which it's metal tubing that you put your arms through, and you have a carabiner. Well, I won't go into exactly how it works, but people were blocking the roadway, and in many cases, the delegates were very, very supportive and understanding. There were a couple cases where people got violent, and I had to calm down the situation because I was a peacekeeper, and that was kind of difficult, a 16-year-old girl holding back big guys who are 2 feet taller than her, but...
When did the police start tear gassing?
They had actually been tear gassing since, I believe, 8 o'clock in the morning. And they'd been shooting rubber bullets and macing. That actually isn't a very well-known fact. However, they didn't start tear gassing in mass until, I believe, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, when a few windows got broken up on 4th.
Josiah, you got attacked by the police. What happened? What was the scene where you were?
Well, I had just left Borders Bookstore, where some people had... I thought I was done protesting for the day, and then trying to account for the students that I saw there, and I was coming out of Borders, where some people had gotten gassed there and the tear gas had entered, then we had to leave the bookstore. So I was trying to meet my wife on across the other side of downtown Seattle, and there were a group of people that were yelling at the police and throwing things at them and apparently about to confront them. And there was a guy who was trying to peacefully stop them. He apparently knew some of them, was trying to dissuade them from doing this, and seemed to be able to do that. I went over there to try to help him because it seemed like it was a really potentially bad situation. And he had his arms raised and was probably about 25, 30 feet in between the protesters and the police. As he was doing that, the police came over to him and struck him very hard in the stomach with his when his hands were raised with a billy club. And I tried to stop them from doing that, and they hit me on the arm with a billy club. Luckily, another police official actually told me later he was from the Navy, which amazed me, but he came and was able to dissuade them and tell them, these guys are trying to stop the violence, don't you see? And he took us away. I'm really thankful that he did, but it was very much an unprovoked act of violence on their part.
And this occurred around what time in the day? Because
that was about 5:30. That was things were really getting bad around that time.
Right, that was right around the time, as I recall, when things really got out of control and the police unleashed, because they had been unleashing tear gas since, as one of the students said, early in the morning. And I remember around noon at the Sheridan being overcome by some tear gas. But it didn't really get completely out of hand until around early evening.
That's right. It got worse later in the day. And, you know, most of the protesters are students, and most of the protesters that I saw were, of course, very, very peaceful and trying to get out issues of substance. And, you know, we really felt like the media didn't cover the issues of substance at all. They just later on, they fortunately did cover more of the police violence, which is a really big issue. But earlier on, they were sort of linking the protesters with some of the people who just committed violence. We're a very, very small percentage of the folks
there were
involved.
About 30 of them.
Exactly. So, you know, we wanted to do this quiz as a way of trying to get out some of the issues of substance that the media didn't seem to cover hardly at all.
Well, let's talk about this quiz. Again, we're talking with a teacher and two students from Nova High School, a public high school in Seattle. Joe Swaya, the teacher, Savan Rosenbaum, and Nicole Bade, the students. Savan, we are looking at a 10-question quiz that you have for the media about the World Trade Organization. Why the media?
Well, the media are who tend to inform the public. The people who weren't at the protest were sitting at home watching it on TV, and judging by the media, you would think that it was some crazy riot downtown, whereas I, when I was downtown, found it to kind of have the elements of some sort of party, almost. There were people in the streets dancing. There was tear gassing going on, but a lot of people were just supporting the people who were doing peaceful, nonviolent lockdowns or barricades. And so we wanted to get the issues that the people were down there protesting out of the media. And so we chose to do a quiz to try and see if the media knew what they were talking about when they were covering this enormous event.
What are some of your questions?
Well, one of our questions, the first one, is what is the potential effect of WTO rulings on U.S. laws and policies and those of countries around the globe?
And some others?
The second is name at least three examples of how the WTO rulings have already affected U.S. laws or policies.
Are we allowed to give the answers?
Yes.
Okay. You guys want to give the answers to the first two that you studied about?
Well, the potential effect of the WTO rulings on U.S. laws and policies is to obsolete them, to make them not relevant. It's overturning our laws. It doesn't have to do that, but it has the possibility and the power to do that, which I think wasn't really brought out in the media, that our democracy and our power to make laws regarding our lives could be overturned by this large organization that isn't really accountable to us.
And some examples of those rulings?
One example is the sea turtle issue, which basically the U.S. had a ban on shrimp that was caught without sea turtle safety devices because sea turtles are endangered species. And that was challenged in the WTO, and we were found to be in violation of free trade. And so that law was overturned. And another example is the Clean Air Act, which was not, it was not overturned, but it was drastically changed. And another example is dolphin-safe tuna.
And in that case, the same situation?
Yes.
What's your third question?
Okay, I'll read that one. The third one is, roughly how many cases have been decided so far by the WTO's dispute resolution panel?
How many?
The answer we got from researching that with Public Citizen was about 25 have been totally decided so far, and that kind of leads into number four, which I'll read as well. In cases considered by the WTO so far, in which claims have been made charging that government laws or policies are barriers to trade, for example, ones relating to the environmental or consumer safety standards, how often have the claims been upheld? And we said that on this one we will allow the media to answer either with the absolute number of cases or with just with the percentage. You guys want to give the answer to that?
Well, 100% of the claims of the challenges to laws have been upheld.
Which means
and
the laws have been overheld.
That, the laws that means have been overturned,
overturned.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to take your 10 questions and we're going to post them on our website at www.democracynow.org. We encourage people to go to it. It also has lots of articles and links to other organizations that put out information on the WTO. Did you get a chance to ask these questions of the corporate media?
We started. We called some of them yesterday, Amy, and we're going to fax out the news release today and call them all, and we're going to invite them to our class, and which is on Thursday. We're also giving them the option to vote over the answer the questions over the phone, and we have a one-time offer of a ribbon and a certificate of mastery for them. We don't have grades at our school, but we will give them you know, some kudos if they can pass it, and we hope they educate the public about it as well.
I'm interested in question number 10. Can you read that? I don't know the answer to it.
You want to read that, Nicole?
In order to attend the welcoming dinner at Seattle's Exhibition Hall and meet the WTO delegates, people were required to make a donation of blank if they wanted to meet with the delegates in order to benefit the WTO. In order to actually meet with the delegates, it was a donation of $50,000.
Yeah, there was a sliding scale of $5,000 to $250,000 to come in, but I guess to actually meet them, they had to pay $50,000.
So were any of you kids there?
Well, that's just not the kind of money my job makes.
Yeah, I asked them if they could postdate a check, but they said no.
I'd like to ask Nicole, where do you go from here after this enormous display of popular dissent? Where do you go from here?
Well, actually, a lot of us are healing right now and trying to figure that out. I know a lot of people who were really, really traumatized by the police brutality and also the media's failure to cover any of the issues, even when you had about 100,000 people out there talking about them. And we actually shut down the World Trade Organization for one day through direct action. There's going to be meetings held in Seattle with the Direct Action Network. And we're trying to figure out, I think there will be a lot of small protests and potentially one annual large one or something like that, but there will be a lot of lobbying involved.
So I just want to ask Sivan, we have about 10 seconds. Has this last week changed your life?
Definitely. I just felt so much energy down at the protests, and I think that's going to stay with me forever to try and continue to promote these issues and make them known and to change them.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us. Joe Swaya, the social studies and government teacher of Nova High School, and his students, Sivan Rosenbaum, 12th grade, Nicole Bade, 11th grade. Again, we'll post on our website at www.democracynow.org. We have a lot of people to thank, including Doug Patterson of KUOW, Mark Torres of the Pacifica Archives, Mike Dolan and Margretta, and the staff at Global Trade Watch of Public Citizen, who arranged for us to be at the United Methodist Church of Seattle, the International Media Center, and particularly the Independent Media Center. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland's our technical director. Matthew Finch is our engineer today. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.